Hello, it's Richard Herring here. Welcome to my podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. And my stand-up tour is about to begin. Can I have my ball back? First stand-up tour in 6 years. Many of you just know me from the podcast. Don't know, I've done 14 or 15 stand-up tours in my own right. I'm a brilliant stand-up comedian, and can I have my ball back? I think it's my best show ever. That's what the audiences are saying. It's about testicular cancer, but it's funny because testicles are funny even though cancer isn't. I'm really pleased with it. I'd love you to come and see it. Bring your friends. Some of the shows selling really well, some of them selling really badly. It's a traditional Richard Herring tour. But here's where I'm going to be. 2nd of May, Thursday at the Luton Hat Factory. It's a small venue, but there are still tickets left. 3rd of May, I'm at the Bury Hedge End, which is near Southampton. That's looking more full, but still some availability. 8th of May, I'm at the Leicester Square Theatre. There's about 10 tickets left for that one, though I am back at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. And then I'm at St Albans on the 9th, Gloucester on the 10th, Chorley Little Theatre on the 11th. That's sold out, but you can join the waiting list. And then the 12th of May, I'm at Glasgow. Afternoon show sold out. Evening show, extra show, put on, still with tickets. And then there's lots more. Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs. And now, enjoy whatever podcast I've given you. It's free. It's all for you. If you want to pay me back, buy a book, come and see a show. That's all I've got to say to you. Love you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, welcome to a surprise edition of Rahulastapa with the amazing John Oliver. Kept this one a secret until broadcast day. I hope you enjoy it. I've been trying to get John on for many, many years, but the wonderful COVID disease has meant it's happened remotely, transatlantically, and it was lots and lots of fun. I'm pretty much better. I'm back in bed, you can see, but I had chemotherapy last week. I'm just a bit tired. It's okay. I've managed to keep going. I've got plenty in the can still. We're going to keep going and hopefully everything's looking all right. I'm feeling lots better. The future should be bright. Let's hope so. Do keep supporting us. GoFasterStripe.com/badges. Do keep watching us on Twitch, twitch.tv/RKHerring. And use your Amazon Prime subscription to subscribe for free and give us free money if you can be asked. GoFasterStripe.com for all your downloads and books needs if you want to contribute. And thank me for still working so hard, even though I've had cancer. So please support me. Nearly all your money goes back into making more podcasts, so you can't lose unless, you know, I die, in which case I'll probably give the money to my kids. Anyway, let's sit back, relax. This is a really great one, and thank you very much to John Oliver for doing this on his day off. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Rahulastapa. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a man who is just walking in now. It's Richard Herring. Hello! Welcome to another episode of Richard Herring's Leopard Sporting Tank Tops podcast. That's right. It's very difficult to come up with a new idea for podcasts. Each week, me and a guest will capture a leopard and attempt to dress it in a tank top of our choice, and the best dressed leopard will win. That's the new format for the show. Though I was hanging around with all the AstraZeneca vaccinees, who I am one of now. It's fantastic. We hate those Pfizer guys. We hate them. And they're spreading all this news that we get blood clots. We don't get blood clots from AstraZeneca. It's the best. after this is all over, there will be a war between AZ and Pfizer, and may the best team win. It is us. They all call it Ralistapa. Anyway, more bollock-based news. a lot of you got annoyed about me talking about discovering I had aphantasia last year, and I did go on about it a lot, that I can't imagine three-dimensional objects or anything in my mind. I can't see anything in my mind. I bet you're wishing I was talking about that again now, don't you? Now I've had a ball off, and that's all I talk about. It's about 2.5 weeks, nearly 3 weeks since I had the operation. Just last week, probably on Friday, I just decided it was time to test it out and see if it still worked. Up until then, it's a bit of a dodgy thing, because you're thinking, you know, what's going to come out? Will anything come out? Is the one that's gone going to still try and suck something out of my body to, throw away? Will there be less? Will there be less volume, which is very important, I know, to you youngsters out there? It seemed to work fine. I'm not sure of whether the volume is less, whether it's half. It didn't seem to be half, but I forgot to do tests beforehand. I should have done some science experiments and collected. And it's nice in that picture, if you're watching the video, that whoever's got that sperm sample has labelled it with sperm. And that is a good thing. Don't put whose sperm it is. Just put a thing saying sperm on there and that will be fine. But anyway, it works. I'm still a man. And maybe half a man, but I'm still a man. And I wish I'd approached it scientifically. In non-bollock-based news, I've been watching Mary Poppins with my children. It's delightful that they loved it. My daughter wanted to watch it twice. She loved it so much. And it's a film set 111 years ago and made before I was born. So it's kind of crazy. But I'd never noticed in the... obviously, the authentic is the main take. It's an authentic glimpse into the life of Cockneys. That's the usual take, isn't it? But there's a lot more to it than the strangled vowel sounds of Dick Van Dyke. My main issue with the film is that the kids who are meant to be too much for the Nanny Bear are two of the most adorable children you could ever hope to meet. It'd be nice to see Poppins dealing with some fucking terrors, though apparently in the book she's a bit nastier. Anyway, my favourite bit, which I'd never noticed before, is when Bert is singing It's a Jolly Holiday with Mary. And then Mary takes a verse. It's meant to be Poppins complimenting the chimney sweep for being a gentleman, but it goes on for so long that it begins to undermine itself and seem like a criticism. I'm almost certain it's deliberate because it's very funny. Poppins sings, "It's a jolly holiday with you, Bert. Gentlemen like you are few, though you're just a diamond in the rough, Bert. Underneath your blood is blue." It's nice. It's so far so complimentary. "You'd never think of pressing your advantage. Forbearance is the hallmark of your creed." Okay, it's nice, I suppose. No need to press the point, Mary. Bert's a nice guy, for sure, yeah, and he's definitely no sex pest. But he's still a human being with needs and desires. He isn't going to try anything on, but that doesn't mean he's not a virile and sexual human being. Poppins, though, insists on clarifying further. "A lady needn't fear when you are near. Your sweet gentility is crystal clear." Dick Van Dyke even pulls a face at this bit, as if to say, all right, that's enough. I'm a nice guy, but it'd be nice if you thought of me as someone who might possibly be a potential sexual partner for someone. But anyway, then, as if to prove Mary Poppins' point, Bert does a funny dance with some penguins with his trousers bunched around his ankles. Yep, no one's going to go do that guy for anything more than laughs. No wonder he has to spend his days poking brushes up chimneys. That's as close as he's ever going to get. That is my Mary. Yeah, it's only taken 60 years, but taken Mary Poppins down there, my fine friends. All right, my guest this week is probably, I mean, it's hard to pick. There's so many roles to pick with this guy. He's probably best known as Dick Pants in The Love Guru. That's probably why we're here today. My favourite role, of course, is Felix Pardiggle in the 1985 BBC adaptation of Bleak House. Will you please welcome the amazing John Oliver? That's not John Oliver, that's Chris Evans. There we go. It's John Oliver. What a terrible disappointment that would be if I had to interview Chris Evans, not that one.
I mean, it's not... the likeness is there. We're not... it's not so shocking that for a second I didn't think, oh, yeah, that is me. I'm wearing a different shirt than I thought.
It could have been like the BBC thing where they got the taxi driver in by mistake.
Yes, exactly.
We've got John Oliver. Oh, no, it's just a bloke in Wales. How are you, John? Thank you so much for doing this.
Fine, thanks. I'm doing all right.
We've been trying to get you on for years and years, but of course you live in America, which made it hard before.
That is the problem. There's been some ocean-based hurdles in the way.
Yeah, but now, thanks to COVID,
that's
we
right.
are straddling the world.
One of the many great things about this crushing pandemic.
So, well, I want to talk a little bit about both those roles that I mentioned in the introduction there, but especially Felix Pardigal, 1985. You must have been a tiny child.
I was six when we filmed it. So right. When we filmed it, when they filmed it, and I was on set. I really don't want to take any ownership over. Well, the BBC and I talked a little about what we wanted the role to be. Yeah, they were filming nearby at the school I went to in Bedford, and they were looking for a kid with black hair and brown eyes.
Right.
I was two for two there. Therefore, next thing I know, I'm 6 years old, being pulled out of school, being dressed up in Victorian clothing, and yeah. I basically end up now living almost an offensive stereotype of an English person in America. Because there's a kind of... There might be a lazy implication of, oh, if you're English, you were probably in a Dickensian drama as a kid, weren't you? Yeah, I was. Did you play an orphan? Shit, yeah, I did. Yeah, I did.
Well, like, but you're unlucky because Daniel Radcliffe was in David Copperfield, wasn't he, which is the BBC adaptation, and he was just born at the right time to then pass over to Harry Potter. I mean, and his mum and dad were casting directors, I think, which might have helped, but... You'd have been a good Harry Potter if he'd been sort of just 5 or 6 years down the line, really, if he'd just been a bit later.
I used to get You Look Like Harry Potter screamed a lot at me in England when I did stand-up. I'd have the amount of time between walking on stage and getting to the microphone, there was just, it would be like, David Baddiel's here. You know he's not. There's six of us here in a basement of a pub. David Baddiel is very much not here. and then Harry Potter when the books came out.
Yeah. Well, it could have been, but that would have been an interesting life, wouldn't it? It would have been a different life. Dick Pants in The Love Guru. I want to tell you that I've never seen The Love Guru, so I can't judge it. I was going to watch it today, and I went to Amazon Prime, and it cost £3.49 to rent it, and I thought, I don't think it's worth it.
£3.49 dusted you off.
Yeah.
£3.40. Oh, so you don't know. So we could be sitting on a masterpiece. You are not in a position to make an informed take on it.
I'm not. I can't really. So you'll have to tell me all about how great it was.
Listen, it seems like I can say whatever I like about it because £3.49 is a barrier of entry that you're not willing to cross at any point in history.
It's a lot of money. I think if I'd gone SD, I think it might have been £2.49. So I could have saved a pound.
You could go SD.
Yeah,
I don't think watching it in SD is going to affect your enjoyment of it.
Okay,
at all.
That was your first film, though, wasn't it? The Love Guru. I mean, it was a Mike Myers film.
Yeah,
and everything was. It must have been very exciting for you to be in.
Really excited. Yeah. It came at a very weird time because there was a writer's strike around that time in America, right. So. I was in big trouble because I was in America on a working visa and all of a sudden I'm striking, which is not great. And so then it was this thing came up and luckily I could go up to Canada and do it. So that was what I spent some of that time doing, and it really came in handy.
Did you think when you knew your character was called Dick Pants that it might be a bad idea to be in the film? Was that a warning bell?
I mean, when you say it like that, you know, that warning bell rings pretty loudly. But at the time, I kind of thought, oh, this will be great. I love Mike Myers. I'm sure this will be really funny. And I will say, you haven't seen it. There are some funny bits in it.
Okay.
There's a very, very funny scene where he gets attacked by a cockerel. And it's good.
Well, maybe. I said to my wife, it's £3.49. She said, your time's probably best spent doing something else. We could have watched it. If I'd thought ahead, we could have watched it like as one of our night's entertainment. But then I might have resented you because we got two young kids.
Yeah, I got two young kids. don't do it. Consider this my gift of £3.49 to you. Don't do it.
Fair enough. I've got my back. I'm quite pleased with the background. I did the White Void thing.
Yes, thank you.
And it actually, if people are watching the video, it's almost, it looks like we could be in the same room.
It's basically seamless, isn't it? I'm in a room adjacent to the White Void, so this has a more greenish hue, which is what you managed to do there.
Yeah, so it's almost like I knew you'd be next door. I thought you might use your studio. You never know. But it's a tribute to you. Anyway, look, the thing I've talked about you a lot on this podcast before when you've come up in conversation with other people is my main memory of us working together. And there's a few times we worked together, and they've usually been disastrous, was a Edinburgh preview in Aldershot, at the West End Centre in Aldershot, where I was doing the 12 Tiles of Hercules Terrace, and you and Andy were doing one of your wordy political shows.
Yes.
To a not very interested audience. In fact, I would say a quite angry audience of squaddies, really.
Aldershot. I think there's a time and a place for the wordy comedy that we were doing at the time. And the time and place was not Aldershot then, that's for sure.
It's a great venue, the West End Centre, and I've done loads of great, lovely tour gigs there. But I think we'd just been booked as a comedy night, hadn't we? And they'd so it was...
That's the problem, isn't it? I sometimes feel for those audiences because, you know, you could say that comedy is a relatively selfish exercise at the best of times. Edinburgh previews are entirely selfish. Really, the main thing you want there is not to entertain, more to have an audience expose the flaws in a show that you can then fix. So, yes. Aldershot exposes a lot of flaws.
So we were both doing early Edinburgh previews. All I know is you got heckled during my set because I came on and started talking about Greek gods, and the guy went, "Oh God, not another one." But I offered him money to leave. I said, "Look, you're not going to enjoy this. I'll tell you right now, you're not going to enjoy it. I'll give you your money back for my half of the show and you can go." He said, "Don't patronise me. I'm going to stay here." Like 45 seconds later, he walked out. I said, "Oh, you could have had your money back, but you didn't." And then he came up to me nose to nose and started shouting at me. And with that stupid bravado of I'm on stage, I just fronted him out. He was probably in the SAS. Could have really seriously hurt me, and I was being really rude to him. And he was, because they came down onto the stage to get out, and he was nose to nose with me, and I fronted out. And then you think, if that happened in any other situation in my life, that's right. No way I would stand my ground.
I'm sorry about that.
No, it wasn't your fault. It was the fault of the universe. But I often wonder if that guy remembers you and Andy, and whether he's sort of seen your rise to fame and success, and he sees you and thinks, "That's that fucking cunt from Aldershot. How's he doing so well?"
I am pretty sure that he would stand by his opinion that day. My opinion hasn't changed. The world has merely shifted around me. I still think he's shit.
But it's sort of an amazing... what's happened to you is one of those amazing success stories that I'm not saying is not deserved, because it is thoroughly deserved. But, you know, we also around that same time did, I can't remember what channel it was for, but it was like a whole, it was the UK trying to do.
That's what I remember. That was for More 4, I think.
Yeah, right. But it was like a panel. I remember it being like a room with a table that went round, and there was like six or seven different acts all trying to sort of chip in and talk about the news. Then we did some video bits, but again, that was the UK attempting to do what it took you to go to America to do it properly.
I did a few. It was around the time that they were often saying that we want to do a version of The Daily Show, and then we're doing a version of that, which is like a very, very offensive impression. That was really bad. All I remember from that was being pretty miserable over the week. I think Mark Dolan was hosting it, right? And I remember feeling very frustrated. And then I think I might have been sitting next to you, and there were satsumas on the table, and you were drawing a penis and balls on the satsuma and turning it out towards the camera. And I actually felt a real sense of relief from you doing that, thinking, "Oh, good. Richard is treating this with exactly the respect that this occasion deserves."
It was a non-broadcast thing, I think, wasn't it? But I think maybe it was broadcast. Was it broadcast?
I think it was broadcast. I think it was broadcast.
Well, Mark Dolan, who's gone, I don't know if you followed Mark Dolan's career path, but he's been on talk radio cutting up masks. He's turned into an anti-masker. On talk radio, he's turned into one of those guys. So, it's interesting the way careers...
Yeah,
turn off at different points. There he was, the host of that show.
He didn't seem to give a shit as host of that show, which is one of the key problems, right? It felt like he seemed to be good at hosting shows. But if you're hosting a show like that one, you kind of want to have some connection to the material, and he had none. He was willing to Ron Burgundy whatever was in the order queue in front of him. And that is kind of the problem. You have to give people, if you want to do a show like that, like The Daily Show, you have to give editorial control and have like a singular authorial voice. Otherwise, it's just not going to work.
So when you went to The Daily Show, do you feel they did it better than the more for? Do you think they had a better idea of how to put together that kind of...
Yeah, I think it was better. Yeah.
Did you go, hey, I did a show in the UK and I think there's some lessons to learn?
I think you're missing a Satsuma on the desk with a penis and balls drawn in felt tip and then angled towards the camera, quietly but defiantly.
Maybe that's what blew it for me. Maybe they watched that. So we're going to have one of these guys. We're going to take him over to The Daily Show. Oh, that guy drew a cock and balls. We can't have him. We can't. He was the one. He was the standout guy. Oh, dear. So, from Aldershot and from that, it's this amazing sort of... And I think when you were working in the UK, you were obviously doing lots of great stuff, but Edinburgh shows and the podcast as well. It felt like you were undervalued. I think on the circuit, people would feel like this is a guy who's good and should be doing better than they're doing.
I think the problem is that I was at that point where there is unhelpfully a kind of friction between you and the audience when you're not quite good enough at doing the thing that you want to be doing that you can effectively sell what you're doing to an audience that doesn't really want it, if that makes sense.
But you were, it was what you and Andy especially were doing together was always really interesting, and the Political Animal shows and the and all those Edinburgh shows you were putting together were very interesting. I mean, I remember on that More 4 show, it's like you had a very tightly scripted, like very dense thing you would do. You'd scripted a conversation to each other that was so fast and dense that I was sitting there going, fucking hell, this is, you know, it's good, but is anyone at home going to be following this? This is full-on stuff. It was, you know, but then to suddenly, I mean, not by chance exactly, but like to get picked up by an American show was sort of a bit of a bolt from the blue, right?
Oh, it was a complete, I mean, I think it was a little bit by chance because... Yeah, Andy and I, the radio shows that we were working on had been canned, so we were in trouble. And then kind of out of nowhere came this invitation to go and meet with The Daily Show. And Jon Stewart had kind of been the North Star of what we'd been thinking of trying to do, like this very, very... thoughtful, editorial, committed satire. And so to get to spend any time with him was pretty thrilling. And then to realize that, oh yeah, if you do it this way, if you take it as seriously as he does, if you work as hard as he has to, you can actually do something amazing. But he had to really fight for his editorial independence. That was kind of one of the many things that I admire about him, was that it wasn't handed to him on a plate. In a sense, I've had it easier because having gone from there and then to HBO, where independence is kind of their MO, it's been easier for me. He had to fight to get that from Comedy Central when he first took over that show.
Sure. And that, I mean, that is that's the success of those shows. And because they feel, I mean, I can't imagine... You know, like pitching your current show Last Week Tonight to like someone in the UK, we're going to talk for, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes about a hard-hitting subject. I just can't see anyone going for it. And I'm going to choose what the subjects are, and me and my team are going to choose the subjects, and you're not going to have anything to do with it, and we can talk about anything we want. The idea of that getting accepted is kind of crazy, and you can sort of see why they would think that, but then it's been such a successful show.
Yeah,
because of that, you know, it's authored by you and your team, but it's, you know, it's very much your thing, and it's not diluted down like so many of these you know, so many things. Even I just did a thing for Comic Relief with Joan and Jerrica, which is people doing pod clashes, and they were coming back and telling us what we could and couldn't do on that, you know. And it was,
yeah,
they booked Joan and Jerrica, who were kind of, you know, offensive agony aunts, and then going, yeah, but that's a bit offensive what you said. Going, yeah, that's so, you know, even when even right. a charity thing that the people are coming in, yeah, because would that be acceptable? So
yeah,
it's, you know, it's an amazing thing to have got that.
It's amazing. I really don't take, there is no point at which I take it for granted, because I know how rare it is, how lucky I am to be able to work under these conditions, which is why I think I'm compelled to want to work so hard at it. Because it feels like, you know, on behalf of all the people that would look at a position like that and think, oh man, if I got to do anything that I wanted, I would want to work really hard, not be lazy like that. So I think that's why we work such long hours to try and get these complicated shows right. Because it feels like it would be pretty fucking ungrateful not to do that.
It does seem like that's a very American work ethic, though, in that. Then when I've seen you and other people talking to people like Seinfeld, I listened to you talking to Conan O'Brien, I think, today on a podcast. And it's that desire to work, which I think, you know, that Mark Dolan thing probably shows that up perfectly. It's that getting an opportunity, even though it's more for and even though it's nothing, and not going, fuck, let's grasp this, let's try and make this up.
Let's and just read the audio as many jokes as we can, Andy. Let's talk too fast for people to fully pick it up in a tone that's completely at odds with what everyone else is doing around the table. It's not a recipe for success, but it is more like there is real excitement to it. So I think I get excited. I'm lucky to have such an amazing team of people that I work with now that I am genuinely pretty excited by the end to try and sell this thing to people that we've been working on for some time, a month and a half.
It's complicated. And, like, you know, it's interesting watching it from the UK because, you know, a lot of the stories obviously are worldwide, but some of the stories are very American-based. But it's really interesting to find out about employment, with the employment, unemployment benefit and stuff in the United States and how that works. And really interesting to hear that. I do notice you sort of started doing this. Was it 2014 you started doing last week? So was it that, or was that The Daily Show?
I think that's right.
You've been doing it for a good
2006,
while.
2006, The Daily Show. So yeah, it must have been 2014. Yeah.
Yeah. And then it's pretty much since you started doing that the world's gone really to shit, which either proves satire doesn't work at all, or I think more likely that you have been going around causing problems so that you can do some good material in your show.
I think history has proven that satire doesn't work. If what you think working means is
well, it doesn't,
systems
all these good,
fall, then yeah, it doesn't work in that sense.
You're making all these good points about stuff, but things have just got worse and worse since you've been on air, I would say. 2014, if everyone had taken it, go, how's it going? Pretty good. Yeah, 2000, pretty good. It's pretty, like, we just had the London Olympics, that was good, and Obama's in, it's pretty good. I think it's going pretty well. And then you took over, and then we slide down.
It's hard to push back on that.
Though I we've been emailing each other every now and again over the last few years. Yeah. And when Trump got in, and you've done a lot of takedowns of Trump and, you know, a lot of really valid stuff. But for all sort of satirists in America, and I certainly as a foreign satirist in America, I kind of wondered whether I was a bit scared for you. I kind of thought anything could happen the next 4 years. Were you, did it scare you that, like, did you feel like physically in danger, or did you just crack on with stuff?
You know what? It might actually go back to a little of what you were saying about your kind of adopted bravery on stage in Aldershot. It might come from a little bit from the same place, which is you get this slightly false sense of defiance and defending the territory that you stand on that maybe I wouldn't if I didn't have a platform, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I was quietly very concerned about my immigration status, just because he's such a famously, consistently vindictive man. And that, you know, that once you've irritated him once, you kind of have an enemy for life. And if your enemy happens to be the president and you've also pissed off his extended family, you're probably not crazy to think the consequences could come from that. But
it felt like his whole presidential campaign was just because of that president's speech dinner with that Obama did, where he took the piss out of him. You saw him stewing in the audience and thinking, this is the moment he decided I'm going to do it. And I'm going to, it felt like his whole presidency was just, I'm going to undo everything that Obama did. And it felt to me like this is his retaliation for you daring to joke about me.
I mean, he'd kind of dipped his toe into running for president almost every presidential cycle, just because the man loves attention to a genuine character fault. When he jumped in, we had actually ignored him until we did our main kind of biography piece about him the Sunday before Super Tuesday. And the only point of doing that was to say, because at that point it seemed like he was going to win Super Tuesday. And historically, if you win Super Tuesday, you're the nominee. And so it felt like it was right on the tipping point from, oh, here's this P.T. Barnum figure right, enjoying the process of running for office and saying, in 48 hours, if he wins this thing, he's the nominee and everything changes. So that was when we first kind of engaged with him. But yeah, it was a very difficult time to be writing comedy, partly because it's difficult writing as the years went by from such a level of despair. Because the stuff that he was stirring up was so ugly it takes a toll. You know, writing jokes from a point of utter despair is something you can do a bit. If you do it a lot, it kind of can cut into you a bit.
I'd love to say, oh, look at you, bad luck going to America where everything's crazy, but it's not been any better here. And then with, you know, COVID coming on the tail end of all of that as well, and then you need to broadcast from your home in a studio. I mean, it's amazing and great that you've carried on doing that, and it's terrific that it works.
It's been amazing, The thing is that it's been utterly exhausting. Just practically difficult doing it with two little kids around, especially early on. But I am immensely grateful. One, because the thing I was most worried about at the start was, if we have to furlough this, I'm responsible for like a weirdly large amount of people on payroll. So I was very anxious just that my staff kept getting paid. So we had to keep trying to do the show. That was almost the primary objective. Like, I need to pay these people. So we have to find a way to keep doing something that resembles our show to an extent that we can keep. It was as reductive as that. Then, as time went on, it was definitely stressful. But I'm really grateful that I got to do it, because I do worry about where my head would have gone in the absence of having these deadlines and this outlet. Yeah. I think I might have sunk into a pretty dark place.
Yeah, I guess that's true. You know, similarly, I mean, on a slightly smaller scale, you know, being able to carry on doing all this stupid stuff I've been doing here from home is just...
The thing is, it's not a small scale. We're operating on exactly the same scale.
Maybe. But, you know, in terms of what we're doing. But, it's you know, it's been... I guess it has. It has been really great to have that distraction. And, you know, I've sort of... It's been a weird year, and the last couple of months have been doubly weird. But it's, you know, I've sort of enjoyed it more than most people would have done. So I think because, and as a performer, my wife said, and I wasn't doing that much stand up, but I was doing this on stage, you know, this show on stage. And my wife says, if I don't go on stage for 3 months and I become a sort of a bit of a nightmare to live with, just then, you know, or that at least once I go back on stage, I'm nicer to, you know, I can get that out.
That might be a better way of framing it.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't think I'm not the worst. I'm not like the worst. I'm always on comedian, but I think there's just something in the performance kind of gives you a bit of, you know, energy and life. And yeah, I think if there'd been nothing to do, it's a sort of depressing enough stuff thing going on already, and that distraction. And also, again, with your show as well, there's people watching it, and that coming up weekly is a sort of highlight for the viewers. You know,
I felt very grateful that. Right, to the extent that this, for the last 15 years, I've kind of been so embedded in current affairs. I've been kind of to a drown-inducing extent. And it's kind of been mentally my best outlet to kind of work out how I feel and how I should feel about things has been trying to create comedy through it. So, yeah, with the last year being so difficult in so many ways, with the pandemic and other things that were happening in America, like having a staff that, you know, that where we can try and work out how we feel about something and try and add, I don't know, some protein to sometimes the horseshit that was going around. It was, yeah. I think at the time I was so tired, I couldn't really see the wood for the trees. But by the end of last year, I could kind of look back and go, I can't believe you all managed to keep everything going the way you did. And to keep an outlet of a show that was interesting and also just constantly stupid as well. Because I wasn't sure how we'd be able to do some of the really, really silly things that are the most joyful thing for us to do on the show. I wasn't sure, especially in April, when things in New York were really bad. Yeah. I wasn't sure the extent to which there was going to be any appetite for stupidity. And when we started to work out that we were going to be able to do a different kind of very stupid thing, it was, kind of head saving. It was so great.
Well, I think like the thing with getting the sewer plant named after you and all of that stuff that led to that, just like picking on a town and getting really angry with the children of the town and threatening to fight them and stuff, or saying, come and fight me. It was, you know, it's joyful. And then for you to, you know, and for them to come round and name the plant
after
you.
It was amazing, actually. Because it's objectively, all it is stupid. But underneath that, for me, because my faith in humanity was taking a few whacks last year, both politically and especially in terms of the way that America was responding to the pandemic. So as crazy as it sounds, doing that one joke, having like a mayor decide to pick up and run with it in a way that was kind of genuinely interesting, and managing to push it uphill, the joke, delicately, while funneling HBO's production money to food banks at the time. I remember standing in that, at that sewage plant when we were going to film that little bit, and kind of, it was the first time I'd been anywhere that was not my house, and feeling so happy. Thinking, oh, we did it. I don't know what we did, but we did it.
So at the beginning of the year, if someone said you're going to go to a sewage plant and be happy as you have been all year, you think, oh, what? it's terrific. I kind of thought you might get dragged out of your bed and you know, taken away by thugs. But I guess you've not really shied away from confrontation in your previous work anyway. So I was rewatching the bit about the gun control that you did with the Daily Show, where you you're very bold in the face.
Only in those moments, though, it is a very different side of me. It's the same as you and Aldershot. Like, I don't. When it comes to work, I guess I am fearless, which is odd because I'm so fearful and I'm so anxious most of the time in my life that something comes over me. Whereas, I don't fear anything.
And do you think, I mean, your wife's worked in the army and was a medic in the army.
Yeah.
And obviously has seen some things that are properly unpleasant.
Yeah.
Do you think that gives you a sense of perspective with your comedy?
A little bit, I think I always had this slight mental shift, even early on with The Daily Show, that where in those interviews, like, my heart rate would go down and I'd kind of disassociate and would be able to do my job to a decent level without letting kind of guilt come in. Basically, Colbert used to say, you just turn your soul, you hang your soul up on a hook at the start of the interview. And I was able to do that. But then, with my wife, like, the situation she was in Fallujah was so bad that, it definitely, if I needed a sense of reality injected in me, then that's a pretty heavy injection.
I think I saw one of the podcasts that I heard you say you'd done a gig and you and your wife said it's like a war zone out there.
Yeah.
She
didn't like that. She doesn't like that turn of phrase.
Let me ask you something.
I think I even said as well, I think I tried to defend myself for a second Before, so I think it might have been before I saw her face. Well, you know, there's bodies everywhere. She went, it's not the same. Think of a different...
different. Like,
think of a different phrase. Like, isn't that what you're supposed like, to do for a living?
It's like working in Aldershot out there, is what you could have said. It's like doing a gig in
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'll ask some emergency questions because people will be upset if I don't. I'm going to go right back to the beginning. I haven't asked this question for a long time, but okay. I think you are the kind of man. I didn't ask Jeremy Paxman this question, and I wish I had. John Oliver, have you ever tried to suck your own cock?
Wait, you didn't ask Jeremy Paxman that question?
I didn't.
Is that because the answer is assumed?
Yeah. He's got a very big cock, apparently. I don't know if that makes it easier or harder.
I don't think it's necessarily penis size. I think it's back flexibility is the issue there, isn't it?
Yeah. Any luck for John Oliver?
I haven't tried to do that.
Wow.
What did you ask Jeremy Paxman? Was there a question adjacent to that you...
I asked him whether he'd rather have a handmaid have out of ham or an armpit that dispenses sun cream, because I hoped he would just keep going, what are you talking about? And then I could go, answer the question. But he answered it quite quick. He answered it after about three times.
What did he want?
I think he wanted the sun cream.
Well, good for him for giving a straight answer.
It's a straight answer. He didn't even need to any of the rules explained. He just went for it. Have you got a preference between a handmaid out of ham or a sun cream armpit? You get like a year's supply of sun cream for you, or the ham hand will grow back, but slowly.
I'll take the sun cream.
Yeah. It's a popular choice. Is it sunny out? Do you need that in New York when you're in New York? Do you need sun cream?
I don't know what about me screams outdoor kid. Which it can be sunny outside. It can be snowing outside. This kid's indoors.
I will. Then you don't need the sun cream. You should have had the ham. I'll ask you a new emergency question based on my recent experience. If you had to have part of your body extracted, but you could choose the part, but if you didn't have it, you'd be killed if you didn't do it. But you can choose the part. Which part? And now there are some stipulations. If you choose fingers, you lose all your. If you can't just have a finger, it has to be a sizable part. All your fingers go. If you choose teeth, it's all your teeth go. It's got to be, if there's more than two of them, you can have just one of them removed. Which body part would you willingly give up? It's got to be useful. It can't be the appendix.
That was literally what I was going to say. No appendix. You can't say that one.
The appendix is, you're not allowed the appendix. What would you have taken off?
This really is you projecting your current situation for everyone you speak to, isn't it?
It is. But
do you want me to say testicle, Rich?
I think testicle's the right answer.
Yeah.
I think if I had to have one thing taken out, because I think kidney.
You did have to have it taken out.
But I didn't want to do it. I think you could take it one ear. I think I might allow you one ear, but it would have to be the whole.
Listen, you're a man for whom, you know, testicles have been, for the male anatomy has been such a muse for you. It's The male anatomy to you has been what Stormy Seas were to JMW Turner. You can see so many different colours and shades in them.
It feels like I'm being punished. I think I'm being punished by my balls for concentrating too much on the penis, which is a common problem in lovemaking, that people concentrate too much on the penis, and my comedy have too much on the penis, not enough balls, and I think this is the revenge
I'll lose a testicle in solidarity with you, Richard. Cool. And I'll lose the opposite one as well.
Okay.
So
we can work together. Maybe we could somehow just fuse, like Siamese twin ourselves together right there.
Yep.
We'd make a super penis out of that. We could have a super penis made of our two penises grafted together. And we have the right number of balls. And then, you know, it'd be complicated, but I think it's worth
spoken doing. Like a true serial killer.
All right, here's a classier question. I'll give you a classy question. If all the world's art galleries and museums got together and said, we love John Oliver, we're going to let him have one thing out of all our art galleries or museums that he can take home and keep, which object of art or history or whatever would you take from all the world's art galleries and museums? Just
that is
one.
A great question.
It is good, isn't it? It's exciting. You learn a lot from the answer.
It's a great question. I mean, your previous two were so bad that you've kind of really effectively set a low bar that makes this seem like, oh, boy, we're in 19th century France discussing around the table with a chiton cigarette.
You've got time. You don't have to rush. It's fine.
I'm trying to think of the things. It probably works better if it's something that I've seen and that really.
Well, it can be. I think if it's something, but you know, you could. So go see. I'll let you into the question. Some people, because you know, you won't know how to interview people, so I'll try and give you some lessons. Some people will choose something valuable so they can sell it. Yeah. Some people will choose something that means a lot to them personally, right. Yeah, or that they really like. So you know, and some people. Someone chose the donations box at the museum the people put their money. That was a good choice. I can't even remember who that was. That was good.
You know what? I might go with something by Anthony Gormley.
Oh yes,
I really loved that. I can't. Was it Horizons? That I think it was might have been either just after or just before I left for America. He did the Horizons exhibition where the figures were standing all over the South Bank, and he stood on the
yeah, that was great. Everywhere.
He did it again. He did a version of it here in New York, actually, and it was still great, but it caused slightly more trouble just because the buildings are higher. You see a figure up there, and it's just a lot of the police getting called saying someone's about to jump. And the answer was, no, it's art. I went, okay. It might be like an Anthony Gormley figure. Just think this.
You could have the Angel of the North in your house, in your garden.
I don't want Angel of the North. That should stay there. I don't want to take that. I just want to take an Angel, because there's lots of those as well.
Yeah.
That, or you know what? There was, when I was at university, the Cambridge Museum had this amazing little picture by William Blake called Christ Child Asleep on the Cross. Have you ever seen that? It's kind of
rings
amazing.
A bell.
There's a baby lying down on a cross on the floor, and then the two parents are kind of just looking horrified. That's pretty good. I loved William Blake.
Yeah.
I'd take an Anthony Gormley or that William Blake. Thank
good
you.
Choices. Very good. Right, let me talk to you about your career. It was nice to ask. Have you ever seen a ghost, though? I should ask you if you've ever seen a ghost, John Oliver. I'm just assuming no. So
no, but
okay.
I remember once as a kid, I think we were on holiday. I think we were in Malvern, and I remember my dad saying, there's gnomes around here. If you see a gnome, you can have a sweet. And I remember looking out the kitchen window, and I was so desperately trying to visualise a gnome. I swear I saw, like, this sweep of colour. And I remember going to my dad and saying, I saw a gnome, and seeing the kind of look on his face of, I mean, I don't think you did. I think I saw a gnome. And I need that fucking sweet right now. So I haven't seen a ghost. I don't think I've seen a gnome. But at one point in my life, I was 100% convinced that I just had.
I think that might be a good new emergency question. I might ask next Andy Oshu next week if she's seen a gnome. and see. I mean, I think for most people, it's not going to get much. But occasionally someone's going to go, fuck yeah. I mean, if I'd asked you it, you'd have shat yourself, wouldn't you? But there you go. That is.
Yes, Rich, I have. Thank you. Do you have my sweet there?
It's a sweet. So, look, I really, you're in, like, two of my all-time favourite sitcoms slash...
Really?
I don't know if Rick and Morty counts as a...
Oh, yeah, right.
...as a sitcom. Rick and Morty and Community.
Yeah.
Both by Dan Harmon.
Yeah.
And, but like, you had to make some interesting choices. You were obviously, you went to America and you started getting offered a lot of work. And you got offered Community, but you wanted to carry on doing The Daily Show. So that's why you're not in Community as much as you might have been, right?
Yeah, I really like them. But, yeah, but I mean, The Daily Show was my dream job. I know lots of people use The Daily Show... perfectly fine to go and do the jobs that they really wanted to do, whereas it was what that was my favourite thing. I wanted to do that.
Sure.
So I was kind of very keen not to kind of get distracted by other stuff. And then when Community came up, I did like the look of it. And I really liked Dan Harmon. And so I did the pilot kind of thinking, well, these things never get picked up anyway. Then it got picked up. And then they were nice enough to kind of work around my schedule. So whenever I had a holiday from The Daily Show, I would go and do an episode or two of Community.
Sure.
Yeah.
And how was it? Because he's notoriously a little bit difficult, Dan Harmon. Or did you? But is that only with people who rub him up the wrong way?
I love him. So, yeah.
I mean, I love him. I don't know him at all, but he's absolutely... I think, you know, he's created two of my absolute all-time favourite.
I mean, he is... I think he would be first to say that... he's not a perfect human being, but as a writer, he's amazing. And so, yeah, it was chaotic at times. I mean, I never had to suffer the full chaos of that set because I just wasn't there all the time. So I would occasionally go back there having been away for 7 or 8 weeks, and you would just see kind of a 1,000-yard stare on everyone that was working there. But the thing that was really inspiring about it was just how hard he and everyone there worked. So hard. Like, to make it just by degree upon degree upon degree better. And that, it wasn't just him. It was the writers also, the set designers. There's so many tiny jokes there. So it was, even the directors that would come in, everything was set up to spend an immense amount of energy on a sitcom that at the time nobody was watching. So I loved it. It was a really inspiring place to be. I'm glad that finally there is a kind of second wave of people coming to it, because at the time it was constantly on the edge of being cancelled. It never quite had enough people to justify its own existence, which was what was so exciting about it in a way as well, in that you can't quite believe that they're getting away with it.
Yeah. Well, I've watched them a lot. We watch them. My wife loves it as well. We do tend to kind of go back to sitcoms we like. So I've seen it a lot. And it's like when you come back to it, though, you sort of, you're amazed by that certain plot lines are in the same show, right? You think, oh, that's the one about this. And then you go, fuck, there's also the one about this and this. Like the one I really love is the one about who's the boss, who is the boss. And you kind of think, oh, that was a big plot line in that show. You look and it's a tiny, tiny part of the show, but it's so good.
That's what's so amazing about it. It felt like, because it's all in 21 minutes, like a 30-minute show is 21 minutes in America. So, yeah, to manage to get it that dense. Like, I've always liked really dense comedy. Because there are jokes, fly-by jokes in Community that other shows would do like a 3-episode arc on, and it's gone in, like you say, 90 seconds. It's amazing. It was really great.
And with Rick and Morty, it's like, I don't know what the process with something like that is. Is that just you're going for a day and read a piece and then walk away? And
that was just the next thing he was working on. So there was no animation at that point. That was just him in LA, me in a sound booth in New York, making some ridiculous sounds, and then him saying, oh, I'll tell you when it's finished. So honestly, I had not watched Rick and Morty until relatively recently. It was only when a few writers on our show went, you know, this thing's incredible, right? So then I started watching and had that same feeling of, God, there is a lot in this.
There really is. There really is. Oh, it's very exciting. And, you know, to top it all, Vanity Smurf in the Smurfs films. I mean, that must have been I mean, that must have put everything into perspective when you got that. Both films as well. They had you back for the second film. I think I've seen them. Mm. I've seen a lot of kids' films. They and, did... I, you know, I, they're well, it's like the Trolls. I thought the Trolls films aren't going to be good, but they're pretty good. This, I think the Smurfs is all right, isn't it? Is it okay or is it not any good, John?
I haven't seen it.
Okay.
So I can't say for sure. And I got busted. I got busted on not having seen it with the second one. It was... Yeah, because you say I was invited back for the second one. The way those contracts work, you do one, you're on the hook. Who was it? I'm just trying to look it up now. Who was it? Who was Papa Smurf? Oh, that's right. That's right. So I went in for the second one, and like they played in a voice. I went, oh, that's Jonathan Winters. How did you get Jonathan Winters for this? They went, he was in the first one too. I went, oh yeah, yeah, totally. Of course he was.
I mean, how did you get him to come back? Oh, it would have been
contractually.
The contract.
Yeah. You know what? We all know what happened here.
There's an amazing cast. I looked at it on IMDb. Katy Perry. Well, you've worked with Katy Perry and Beyonce. You've worked with Beyonce.
Yes, I've worked with both of them, and of course neither of them, because again, you're in a booth alone. I will say there is there's a fantastic. I think you know what. Now I'm trying to remember why I did the Smurfs, and now I remember it was literally to make Andy laugh because I was doing the bugle at the time. And I thought, great, to the voice of a Smurf. This is something we can enjoy for a long time.
Did you do any rip?
It did well enough for a second one. And then they say, oh, we've written Vanity Smurf in as a bigger role. And you go, ah, fuck, this joke is really blowing up in my face now.
What research did you do before you took on the part of Vanity Smurf?
Well, I mean... You've got to take any role seriously, right?
Sure.
So you want to try and get into the head of Vanity Smurf as much. So I went back to lots of those Greek Narcissus texts. You want yes. to really work out why Vanity Smurf is like this and why he carries a mirror around all the time to peer upon his own reflection. What flaw is... in him that needs that, what hunger needs to be filled. So, I mean, whether that comes out in the performance doesn't matter. It was there.
And did you listen to the Smurfs, the single by the Smurfs? Where are you all coming? I'd have been starting.
There are so many fun moments there. When you as an adult, are in a booth, like a really expensive sound booth, and then behind the glass, there's other adults... saying, okay, so now all the other Smurfs are coming in, so can you make a noise like you're happy? You're going, fuck yeah, I can. This is what... If someone had told me this is what being a grown-up was going to be like, I'd have welcomed it. Yeah, so they did say at the end, and now if you can do the Smurf song, there's a big song at the end, so if you can just sing it, and then we'll mix it in at the end. And I said, are you going to mix it down so Katy Perry's louder? And... silence.
Oh, dear. But you also, with your Daily Show, I think it was the Daily Show time, you had a chance to be in the basically a Monty Python film, and you turned that down. Is that true? I read that you were offered the part. The Terry Jones film with all the Monty Python guys in absolutely anything. I read that you were offered that part.
I think, I don't know entirely how the movie industry works. You can go back through my history of films. But Terry Jones, who was one of my absolute heroes growing up, he came to New York and he said, oh, do you want to have breakfast? And so I went out for breakfast with him and he said, I've written a script, will you? Do you want to be in it? So I just said yes. And then next thing I know, there was like some headline saying, oh, Terry Jones' film with... like John Oliver attached is in it. So I had to kind of go into John Stewart's office and went, I just said yes. I don't know when this is happening. And he said, don't worry about it. They're just trying to raise money. And then I think he said, and your name's attached, so it's not going to happen. He wasn't fucking wrong. But so the nice thing was for the year that was in kind of develop, that Terry was developing that, I got to kind of just exchange emails with him over that year, and it was such a fantastic man. He was so clever, so sweet, so thoughtful, and so when he passed away, it was kind of nice going back through emails and like he would just send little recommendations for, oh, have you read this? It's often medieval poetry. The guy likes medieval poetry. Have you read this? No, Terry. No. And if you're sending me the best, I think I'm standing by my instinct. But yeah, it was just absolutely amazing to spend a little bit of time with him. I saw him again when Monty Python did a Q&A, all of them before a screening of, it might have been Life of Brian, I can't remember. And he was starting to fade a little bit there.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. But God, he was what a fantastic, incredibly funny man.
Yes, he was. He was. I've met him a couple of times, but not really in any proper way. But I sort of met him when I was a student, when he was doing a book signing. And but then I gave him, after the Python, the live shows they did, he won a Chortle Award. And I ended up, because whoever was meant to award it to him didn't turn up. So I ended up giving him this Chortle Award.
I remember during that breakfast, it took me so long. Like a full half an hour of the first half an hour of being able to really concentrate on what he was saying, just because I couldn't believe his face and voice was in front of me. And it was, and just as I'd started to relax, he was talking about how hot it was outside. And he went, I've not been this hot since, years ago with the guys. We had to direct this film. And it was we were making it look like somewhere else, but we were shooting in North Africa. And I'm thinking, Life of fucking Brian. I know what you're talking about. The seminal comedy film of my childhood, Terry. All right, now yes. I can't concentrate on my omelette anymore.
It is sort of. I mean, no, it's. I know what a big comedy fan you were, and I read that you'd sort of accidentally been shown Life of Brian at school, right?
Yes, by a teacher. It was amazing. Like a supply teacher. Who I think that was the case, who came in and it was just like, I'll put this on in front of the kids, and then either left or wasn't listening. I remember, 45 minutes in thinking, there's no way you should have showed us this. And this is the greatest thing I've ever seen.
But yeah, so I mean, I interviewed Michael Palin in the last live gig I did back in March last year. I interviewed Michael Palin, which was just like that, and I think I said to him at the end, I can die happy now, this is it.
It's difficult, isn't it? It's difficult because you know that they don't want to hear it. But you, there's no real point in saying it, but when it matters that much to you, it's very, very hard not to say, oh, I feel like you might have fundamentally changed the direction of my life. Anyway, do you want a yogurt?
Oh dear. Let me have a look. The other thing I was there was one other maybe it was the Lion King I was gonna oh, the story I enjoyed again from your early days. I've been talking about all the good things you've done, which is very unlike me. I remember
plenty,
you talking,
there's plenty of things for you to slap me with.
There are. I'm going to find some things to slap down. And this is, you talked about having 100% walkout at the Edinburgh Fringe in one of your Edinburgh Fringe shows, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah. Well, it is impressive if if you start with a large number. If you start with four, it's not that impressive, is it? That's just two couple. One couple making the easy decision. One asshole abandoning his wife to the really hard decision.
And was there any part of you thought I should carry on or I should wait in case anyone comes back?
Yes, definitely. And also, it's not the only time it happened. Andy and I had a 100% walkout at, I think, he could verify this, I think it was an Edinburgh preview at The Space. Do you remember The Space? Do you remember when we used to do them there? Yeah. I think we had a 100% walkout there too.
Right, yes.
Yeah. But that's less lonely because I'm on stage with someone.
That's right. I think I might have been... Wasn't that, though... I think I might have followed you at that one. I think I might have been on after you at that one as well, because I think there was the football on or something. Wasn't there?
Yes.
There was a time where it was the World Cup was on.
That's right.
So there was literally no one coming to those shows.
The some of my favourite gigs on the network were in student unions, where you would have some ENTS officer not really understanding what they're about to do. As a football game is on the screen, they'll say, oh, no, we'll just turn it off. When you can, but you're going to hear a noise, and that noise is going to turn into hostility, and that hostility is what I'm going to be performing to. So it's up to you.
So do you think all this... You seem to be the same person as you were 10 years ago. I've seen a lot of people... You know, I've seen a lot of people go to Hollywood and...
I haven't gone to Hollywood.
Change a little bit, or to America, or become very successful, become that kind of successful, and change quite a lot. Do you still feel like you're the same John Oliver as who died at all those gigs?
I think so. I still fundamentally identify more with failure than success. So, yeah, it doesn't really feel like anything has changed. To be honest, I worked with John Stewart for so many years. He's pretty unaffected. And also, we're kind of working in a bubble there. I don't really go anywhere. So once a year, back then and now, I go to the Emmys, and that's more of a moment where you kind of remind yourself, oh, I work in television. Because until that point, it really doesn't feel that way much at all, especially now. Like, I'm just alone in a room. So, yeah, there's no... And I don't see anyone or do anything. So it's... I don't think it has changed me at all, really.
You do seem the same, you know. And it's not always... for the worst, but I think I think you're working very hard, and it obviously takes it's a big pressure, and I think it's hard to be doing this year in and year out, right?
Yeah, it's a grind, about John, for sure.
I know you talked about John Stewart, like by the end, like looking tired to his bones.
Definitely,
and,
yeah.
You know, and that's going to presumably that there's a shelf life to it in terms of just your ability to carry on putting in that amount of work.
Because I think you should do it. Like, it goes back to what we were saying at the start. Like, if you get the opportunity to do this however you want to do it, especially with a kind of budget that means you can do spectacular, fun things, then you should do it at like the highest rate and the highest effort that you can. And if you feel like you have to drop down a bit, you should just stop. Because I think at that point as well, it might start making me miserable. Still, now it's still exciting because it still feels like you're like anything is possible. You can find ways to tell stories that are... either silly or spectacular, and the show can kind of change as you go, tackling different things. I think if I started feeling like I couldn't, you know, when I was in England, I was pretty sad and sometimes resentful, because like you were talking about, in those moments where like BBC Radio is giving notes that you know are wrong, but you have to find a way to kind of wrestle with them. I've been really lucky not to have those notes over the last 10 years. I think if it starts to feel like I am the reason that I am, that the show isn't as good as it should be, I need to fucking stop at that point.
Well, because make sure you get some.
All the staff work too hard for me to be the reason that things fuck up.
Job. Yeah, I mean, it's great, but I, you know, also you see people like work and, you know, it's also just, you know, I think you've probably got a good balance. And it's like you say, working at home has probably been nice because you've been with the family and everything. But it's just making sure. It's such a hard thing because you've got to work so hard to get to where you've got to. And you've got to carry on working. And, you know, but at some point you want to be able to enjoy the fruits of it. I guess, you know, just having faced mortality, looked mortality in the face.
Yeah.
You sort of think, you know, are you getting...
The fruits of it for me are the show, though. That's the thing, is getting to do it. Like the other fruits actually aren't really a motivating factor. So the thing itself, like if we do something, like we did a couple of years ago, we got to the end of this. We'd been sued by this coal CEO, and it took years, and I was really angry about it because he was a kind of brutal bully. And had launched these lawsuits against local papers here and had managed to kind of force people into silence. So we got to the end of this, we won it, and then we staged this massive musical in Times Square, and just to tell him to go fuck himself. And it was just the most euphoric feeling, just because we were shooting it on an utterly absurd scale. Everyone, like, we had the trucks and lights, and an orchestra had scored the song, and everyone had worked so hard just to tell this guy to go fuck himself. And it really felt, if that's the fruit for me, that's the sweetest fruit.
Well, I do, and I love the sort of charity aspect of the show as well, and that often you're offering rewards to food banks or whatever, or channeling money into the right into deserving.
That's the causes. Thing. Like last year, all of a sudden, our production costs go down because right. we're not in a studio, so it felt like we have to find a way to money launder HBO's budget to worthy causes. So it was basically a year of that. Any joke would have a punchline sometimes of, and we'll give $20,000 to food bank. Fucking go.
It's great. Well, look, the one thing, I'll ask you one more thing and then we'll let you go because you've been very kind to give up your day off to talk to us. What do you think we can do a show like any of the shows we're talking about in the UK? Why is it not working? The MASH report, I don't know if you've seen the MASH report, which I always enjoyed, has just been, it's Nish Kumar sort of, is the best, I think, the UK have done at doing a show of this sort, although it's just been cancelled for, I think, we can safely say some political reasons.
Oh, really?
Well, the tabloids didn't really like it and were after it, partly because Nish, I think, he's born in the UK, but I think they've got some problem with him. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
You know, but they were critical of the government, as any satirical show could be. So they had four series. It was pretty good. But do you think, is there a reason why it isn't really working in Britain in the same way as it seems to work in America? Or
I don't know.
Because you're from Britain, right? So there's no reason why it couldn't, this show couldn't.
And I certainly had like my fair share of bad experiences of that. I think the BBC is tricky, isn't it? Because was the MASH report on the BBC?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my experience there was so bad because it felt like there was always mitigating factors, often pertaining to, like, for some reason, being needed to be seen to strike a balance. I don't really know what that means. I'm not sure they can articulate it either, other than hitting all sides. Horseshit, which is so intellectually bankrupt, it's hard. Yeah. It's hard to engage in good faith with a bad faith argument without just hemorrhaging energy. But so the BBC was pretty tricky for that. Although, I mean, having said that, Armando managed to do things his way. I think the key thing is, I guess broadly, yes, there is absolutely no reason. I think that the UK couldn't do it. I think the key thing is, what you have to find a way to do is build up enough credit somehow to be left alone, and then spend that credit on that and nothing else. Like, there is nothing more important than them leaving you the fuck alone.
Sure. And I guess Armando did have that. I think Armando also probably... it was never... weirdly, it was sort of targeted quite broadly, wasn't it, at the media and at government,
right,
and that,
right.
You know, it was never, I hate Boris Johnson.
That's true. You know, I guess that's what I loved about it so much. It was often conceptual rather than personal. I mean, I do think just broadly getting too into the personalities of politicians is fun, low-hanging fruit. But policy is more interesting than personality, always. It's just harder to make jokes about, but it feels better when you do it. But to your larger point, I really think there is no reason why the UK couldn't do it. I think in the past, when I was there, I used to think, well, we just need a Jon Stewart figure. And he was preternaturally talented, but he also sacrificed a bunch of stuff, I sort of do, so that he could get the thing that was most important to him, which is editorial control.
Sure.
So I think that was, even in contract negotiations for him, the most important thing was, I get editorial control, because otherwise I can't do my job. And he was right about that.
Yeah. It's fascinating. It's sort of, you know, I'm delighted it's happened for you. It's definitely worked out for you. And obviously your life is completely different as a result of this happening. But it's, you know, from a comedy perspective, it sort of just seems, you know, you are enough of an outsider in the UK to still be an outsider in the UK. You know, it doesn't matter that you're, you know, I think you being British adds a little bit to you doing an American show, but not, I think it, that's maybe to begin with, right? You were an English voice.
I think to begin with,
voice,
for sure.
Yeah. But it's, but now it doesn't seem to be anything to do with it. So it's a shame we've lost you. But I'm delighted we have, because the shows you do are all fantastic. And it's all going on now, right? So it's still, and we can watch it in the UK. It's on Sky, it's on Now TV in the UK, and often stuff turns up on social media and YouTube
oh, great.
And things like that.
Yeah.
So people can watch these shows. If you haven't watched them, go and watch them all. They're great.
Yeah. That Man and, in Aldershot. You know, just give me a chance. Just watch the first 5 minutes of one. And if you honestly find yourself thinking, not this shit again, then listen, you were right all along.
He was right. Maybe he was right. thanks so much for your time, John. I won't take up any more of it. Ladies and gentlemen, the amazing John Oliver. Thank you very much. We're back next week with Andy Osho. Thank you very much. We will see you. Goodbye. You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Rich Herring, and my guest, John Oliver. Thank you to Pest for providing the music. Thank you very much to Chris Evans, not that one, who I am indebted to for all his hard work on this show. Thank you to Ben Walker also. And thank you to everyone at Acast for the fine support we get from you. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Head to GoFasterStripe.com. You can buy my books, you can buy my downloads, you can buy DVDs if you want to go old school. And you can also buy shows from loads and loads of fantastic comedians who wouldn't have a platform were it not for the wonderful largesse and comedy fandom of Chris Evans, not that one, or that one, or the Davies Hero editor, or any of the politician ones, or any of the other Welsh ones. It's Dark Receptions is the one I'm talking about.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening. Do come and see me on tour. richardherring.com/gigs is the easiest way to find out where I'm going. And gofasterstripe.com. You can buy books and downloads. And just tell your friends about the podcast. If you can't make it to the tour show, if you don't want to buy any products, then every time you listen to an advert, you're helping us make more podcasts with a very, very tiny micro payment. So thank you very much for that. I love you all. It's lovely to meet you on tour, by the way. Hello to everyone who said hello so far. Do come and say hello after the show if you enjoyed it, if you want to see me. That'd be nice. You can get a selfie. I don't care. I'm a selfie whore. All right, see you soon.